Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling, and we are joined by Leighton Kling for this episode. Coming up on today's show, we'll talk with Keith Cohn. He's the founder and CEO of Candy Club. Now, Candy Club is a wholesaler to retailers, and they service 5 figures worth of retail doors in the U.S. They also sell direct to consumer, and he's going to join us to talk about where things are headed in the candy space and also what his company does and some areas of the store that you might not think about when you think about confectionery or when you think about impulse buys. Very fascinating interview with him coming up later on. We'll also have a looking ahead segment where each Leighton and I will talk about a story we're keeping an eye on for the next week or month. Now, our lead news story is Academy Sports and Outdoors, and we'll get to them in a second. Before we do, we want to remind everyone that you can like us and rate us however you access us. If you enjoy the show, rating us helps others to find our show, and we have, based on the number of people reaching out, a number of new listeners, and we thank all of the new and pre-existing listeners that have checked out the podcast over the last nearly 6 years now. It's hard to believe it's been that long. You can also check us out on social media at Retail Podcast. So we haven't discussed Academy Sports and Outdoors in nearly 3 years on the show. And Leighton, until recently, they'd been a private company, which made news difficult to come by for them. As such, we didn't really talk about them, but now we get their first earnings call since their IPO back in October.
Yeah, the headline for their call on Thursday, December 10th, was a significant beat on analyst expectations for both earnings and revenue. Although analysts could be given a pass for not having a finger completely on the pulse of Academy, since they are, like Trent said, newly public. In any case, consensus estimates had earnings pegged at 39 cents per share, while Academy came in with adjusted earnings per share of 91 cents. They also beat on revenue estimates by around $84.7 million, and that does sound like a lot of money, especially around this time when there's a pandemic going on, and you would think that discretionary buying habits may be tapering off a little bit. But before we get into other notable earnings numbers, let's talk a bit about the space Academy occupies as a retailer. Because of their regionality, many of our listeners may not have heard of them. The chain actually got its start back in 1938 in Texas. They're now headquartered in Houston, just outside of Houston, actually. Since their founding, Academy has seen a lot of steady growth in store count, mostly in the southern U.S., and they have now 259 stores in over 16 states, ranging as far north as Illinois and Indiana, and as far east as Florida and North Carolina. Their range stops at the Rocky Mountains going west. Additionally, growth in sales has been just as substantial as their growth in locations. They eclipsed $1 billion in revenue in 2003, but should break the $5 billion annual revenue mark this year. In fact, year over year, through the first 39 weeks of fiscal 2020, the revenue is up 18%. So they're certainly on track to do great numbers through the next few years. In terms of their merchandise mix, you're looking at a cross between Dick's Sporting Goods and Sportsman's Warehouse. Although they carry a significant amount of sports equipment, particularly for baseball, softball, golf, and football in most of their markets, about half of their store is devoted to outdoors recreation, hence the Sportsman's Warehouse comparison. This not only means firearms, but also a significant fishing section, canoes and kayaks and camping supplies. Overall, their store footprint is roughly analogous to Dick's, but most of their stores are freestanding and in the 40,000 to 50,000 square foot range. Some have been spotted in old Kmarts as an example, where stores can be much larger. Competitors include Dunlop's and Scheels on a regional basis, as well as the likes of Hibbett Sports, Big Five Sporting Goods, and Sportsman's Warehouse in other regional markets.
So now that we've kind of defined Academy Sports and Outdoors as a company, let's talk about their earnings release. And the headline in the company release included the words record-breaking, and that wasn't hyperbole, as this was certainly a fantastic quarter for them, their best third quarter ever in the history of the company. Comp store sales, you know, Leighton talked about their revenue being up year over year for the first 39 weeks of fiscal 2020. Comp sales continued that momentum, an increase of 16.5% year over year for the third quarter. Overall net sales increased 17.8% year over year as a result of expanded store count and those comps. So right in line with that 18% that Leighton mentioned here year over year to date. E-commerce sales, which were included in those comps, were up in that about 100% range we've come to expect in 2020 from specialty retailers. The actual number was 95.9% year over year. Academy, like so many other specialty retailers out there, e-commerce wasn't really completely mature coming into this year, so they did have room for growth, and they were able to exercise some of that room for growth during the last couple of quarters. They were also quick to point out that their stores are still the main driver of e-commerce sales and sales overall. 95% of Academy's overall sales, and this includes e-commerce sales, touch the stores in some way. About half, or a little over half, of their e-commerce sales were either buy online, pick up in store, or curbside, meaning a couple of things for Academy, but mainly saving on those shipping costs that are said to hamstring a lot of retailers over the last 6 months. And for Academy, the fact that 95% of sales touch stores doesn't only mean buy online, pick up in store, or curbside. Now, Academy as a company, they only have 3 distribution centers to service all of their stores, all of those 259 stores that Leighton spoke of. As such, they fulfill a significant number of e-commerce orders directly from stores rather than gumming up their somewhat limited distribution center footprint with that fulfillment work. So again, fulfilling a lot of items from stores, not unlike Target, which is known to fulfill a lot of items from their stores, and that's kind of their e-commerce calling card, if you will. Now, the company on the call, between everyone that was involved on the call, there were 4 Academy representatives on this call, they kind of hinted that their brick and mortar footprint was crucial to driving sales in the third quarter because they not only saw people coming to the physical stores themselves, but a demand, a notable demand for customers to pick up their items either curbside or in the store after they've placed an order. Now, as far as those sales increases are concerned, this is a relatively new development for Academy. As we mentioned, because this is the first time we're really diving deep on Academy, it's important to take this with some historical perspective. When we got numbers from Academy prior to their IPO, it was indicated that 2018 and the first half of 2019 didn't see the same robust increases in sales that we've seen the last 2 or 3 quarters. In fact, only 6 quarters ago for Academy, comps were negative. So putting it all in perspective, this is certainly a big quarter for Academy, but it's kind of restarted the growth that had stalled out during the 2017, 2018, beginning of 2019 periods. So that's a good sign for Academy. And Leighton, they did talk about specific category growth on the call itself, which of course, in this sector, we always find interesting.
Yeah, very interesting indeed. Their overall categories here include sports and recreation, outdoors, footwear, apparel, and others. However, it was sports and recreation and outdoor that carried the comps for the company. Specifically, Academy noted bicycles, outdoor games, outdoor cooking, and fitness equipment driving their sports and recreation division. And yes, outdoor games and outdoor cooking are in sports and recreation for them, not outdoors. Meanwhile, the outdoors category saw momentum from fishing, camping, and hunting categories. Basically, they saw broad-based sales increases in this division. What they said on the call mirrors what we've seen from other retailers. Academy leadership said people are aching to get outside, be active, and take a more intentional look at their overall health. As such, Academy was in a great place to benefit, which they certainly did, as you can tell. Away from those two categories, footwear also saw an increase, but a more slight one than the other active categories. The increase was mid-single digits and was driven by both what they call life and work categories. They have a more extensive selection of work footwear than, say, a Big Five, Hibbett, or Dick's Sporting Goods would. On the negative side, they saw a low single-digit decrease in comps and apparel. When evaluated against a macro backdrop, this is no surprise, with apparel sales generally having been tepid during the pandemic as a whole. However, Academy actually placed the blame on something else entirely: the Astros 2019 World Series win. See, with many of their stores in South Texas. When the Astros won the World Series in 2019, Academy saw a massive demand for merchandise. Since it was the Dodgers' win in 2020, the same demand didn't arise this quarter, and as such, apparel sales comped out negative. In fact, they specifically said apparel would have been positive if not for the Astros' gear. They also said that the different back-to-school landscape didn't necessarily help matters in apparel either. A note that we found interesting, inventory flow continues to be solid without supply chain interruptions, with the exception of one category, firearms and ammunition, which they noted will continue to be a challenge for the foreseeable future. We should note this as we look at other retailers like Sportsman's Warehouse, who have such a high proportion of revenue coming in from this particular category.
And then finally, to round out the call notes, they were asked by an analyst on the call to look forward to the next 12 months and discuss factors that might determine Academy's success. And again, something that's so important when you're setting a baseline for a newly public retailer. It was a great open-ended question asked by the analyst, and they gave a very thorough answer. CEO Ken Hicks, who I should mention on the call, actually, he coughed a little bit and had to step away from the phone, and he joked that it was the sales of the company, the great sales numbers, that had him all choked up. But in any case, he noted many things when asked this question, the first of which is allocating or reallocating floor space correctly as consumer demand shifts based on not only pandemic responses, but other changes in consumer tastes. Of course, this is not only about optimizing floor space, but if you're going to give a product more floor space, you got to make sure inventory levels are correct and in check. Inventory levels and pricing, he noted that they have AI programs in place now that they expect to only optimize those going forward. He used an example, in fact, of stores near the Texas-Mexico border carrying smaller sizes, especially in footwear, but also in shirts and apparel in general, as an example of kind of their attempts via these programs to localize inventory. Now, we've talked about localized inventory for Dick's quite a bit over the last 2 to 3 years as they continue to tweak things based on where these stores are located. And another example, Hicks mentioned that grills could be a big category in 2021, but he said that grill preference really differs by region. And this is some of the insights that their software has been giving them. Gas grills fly off the shelves in the Midwest more than they do in their other regions. Wood pellet grills are the thing in the South. So it's not only incumbent upon Dick's to make sure that they're giving floor space to those individual items in those individual areas, but making sure also that they carry ample inventory for the adjacent products. You talk about wood pellet grills. Of course, you think about the wood pellets that you need to heat those grills. You think about gas grills in the Midwest. You think about propane and propane exchanges. So making sure that you've got your propane exchange programs working, all of that kind of on their mind heading into 2021. Additionally, Academy hopes to build further on their private label programs over the next 12 months. Private labels have been killing it in sporting goods lately. Academy hopes to do this not only with marketing, but they've got a number of new items and rollouts in the pipeline that are ready and raring to go for 2021. Chief Merchandising Officer Steve Lawrence, who was also on the call, noted that markdown optimization is going to be key in 2021. And one thing they'd like to see more of is doing more slight markdowns in season versus waiting until out of season. Basically, if you've got a summer product that's there, maybe reducing that summer product to 15% off in July versus waiting until September and marking it down 30% off. They've noticed when they do this, this has the effect of speeding sell-through, which also clears that valuable floor space that we talked about. But also, this is the big one for their bottom line, increases margins because the discounts don't have to be as steep. So it's a matter of really assessing their product assortment week by week rather than season by season here and discounting, even if it's slight, a little bit more as they go to entice people to take those items off of the shelves before it's out of season. And finally, Lawrence, once again their CMO, said that they're working to expand their team sports selection beyond the beginning athlete. And I found this interesting because historically I've lived in markets with academies in the past. This has not been a strong suit of Academy is team sports. They have sporting goods, but not really, you know, the team jerseys, the team baseball pants, and so forth. But they want to be the source for team apparel all the way up through the late teen years. So they said basically they've got to not only figure out the floor space, but also the size and size diversity needed to get into team sports. And that this is a tricky category because, again, you're talking about sizes and you're talking about kids that are growing relatively quickly. So that's something they want to get the finger on the pulse of for the next 12 months because they feel like it could be a big category, not necessarily in 2021, but looking ahead the next 5 years for Academy. Well, that'll do it for our news segment here on the show. Coming up after this short break, we'll be joined by Keith Cohn. He is the founder and CEO of Candy Club. And once again, we're going to talk to him about the state of confectionery retail in the U.S., what differentiators exist in confectionery retail, and ways in which retailers can actually market confectionery products to ensure that they are getting the most from those impulse buys. One thing we've learned during the nearly 6 years that we've been doing this podcast is that our listeners love when we talk about an oft-overlooked segment of retail, one that's important and not overlooked by retailers in terms of driving sales, but maybe one that doesn't get the press of some of the other segments. Today's focus is confectionery or candy retail, and who better to discuss that neighborhood than Keith Cohn, the founder of Candy Club. Candy Club is both a wholesale supplier of candy to retailers and a direct-to-consumer seller of candy. At the end of their third quarter, to give you an idea, they served over 11,700 retail doors, large and small, from boutiques to larger partners like Kohl's and Winco Foods. Keith, we're so happy to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to meet you, Trent.
So I gave a bit of an introduction regarding Candy Club, but I was wondering if you minded just discussing a bit about Candy Club's history and the current scope of operations there, just so our listeners have an idea of the perspective that you bring.
Yeah, great. So Candy Club operates in two distinct sectors of the confectionery business. The first, I founded the business in 2015, focused solely on subscriptions. Back in 2015, the subscription economy was booming, and I saw an opportunity to do something in the confectionery space. Nobody was doing anything there. And so we created really the first scalable Candy of the Month Club, essentially, is what it boils down to. We operated that business as a pure play for about 3 years. And then in 2019, we pivoted to adding a wholesale side of the business. So serving retailers, big and small, as you've said, not necessarily focused though on the mass market. Where we saw the opportunity was where we consider white space. There's confectionery at the checkout of every mass merchant already. But if you look at the specialty market, specialty apparel, department stores, we saw an opportunity to take advantage of that underutilized space. And so that's really where we're focused.
And you can see that certainly in terms of your sales. Sales have really taken off over the last couple of years for Candy Club. I want to step back beyond Candy Club. Where do we stand right now in terms of confectionery retail heading into 21? What's the landscape look like for someone that's not involved in it on a day-to-day basis?
So it's a $40 billion category at wholesale. So it's a very big category. And it's one of those that's really overlooked. You know, people are looking at in a lot of areas. You're looking at, of course, plant-based and a lot of the health sector there. But it's a very big category. It is overlooked to a large degree. And so that's where I saw the opportunity is to go in there, be disruptive, innovate with new product and new execution. But it's a very healthy category. The category increases year over year. And when you're in a down market, like we are right now, in recessionary times or really in any kind of troubled times, confectionery goes up. It's one of the few categories that's really resilient there. People gravitate towards comfort foods. And I believe the category is up somewhere between 8 and 14% this year, depending on what research you look at.
So we see sales not only for Candy Club, but the entire industry certainly increasing. And I'm curious because in looking at the displays that you have in the likes of the retailers like Kohl's, for example, things are merchandised so well. And, you know, if you've ever been to a grocery store, you go down the candy aisle, oftentimes you'll see like gummy worms in these very generic looking packages and that type of thing. What are some of the most substantial changes we've seen in terms of how candy, how sweets are retailed, not only retailed, but also presented in brick and mortar stores over the last 10 years?
Yeah, it's a great question. Again, this is where we saw the opportunity. Not much has changed from our perspective in the mass market side of things. So products that you see merchandised at the checkout aisle, which they're at the checkout aisle everywhere. I mean, it's a great big business, but it's been a pretty staid business in the mass market. The opportunity is to take differentiated products We represent really a specialty market candy store. If you think about it, Dillon's, people may be familiar with. And we've got a mix that is really focused more around unique products that we scour the globe to curate into our line. And then we package them in cute, giftable packaging. They're higher price points. And so it really allows a retailer like a Kohl's, we're also in a dozen national retailers across the country right now, and allows them to put a differentiated offer there. So something different. And it doesn't just have to live at checkout. Kohl's, for example, that you brought up, we're in a curated by Kohl's section, which is brands that they bring in, emerging brands. We're also in their juniors department because it's a very kid-friendly program. So product can really go anywhere, and it's merchandise with, you know, really differentiated product and packaging.
And that actually leads me right into my next question, because we're so used to thinking of impulse buys as something near the checkout, near the front end. But as you mentioned, your partnership with Kohl's has the product in various different areas throughout the store. What are some areas you see, as you mentioned, white space, potential for this particular segment of retail? What are some other ways in which you're kind of pushing that product out into the store aisles rather than just keeping it on the front end?
So the front end is obviously, I would say that's the North Star. If you can get there, it's the most valuable real estate. And so that's one of the things we are pushing hard for. But subsequent to that, the product can really go anywhere. There are gifting sections within department stores. There are seasonal sections within department stores. We've got a very robust seasonal offering. So in addition to our core products that retailers carry all year round, we kind of follow the Hallmark holiday release schedule with our candies. So Valentine's Day, Easter, Mother's Day, of course, Halloween, and then around the holidays, we have themed candy as well. And so those can go really anywhere within a store that you're merchandising seasonal product. And then, like I said, it can go in a junior's department and go in a gifting section. So there are multiple opportunities for retailers to put this in multiple places within the store.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, because we've talked about the big ones, obviously Kohl's or Nordstrom Rack and so forth, but you partner with a lot of boutiques or maybe single location stores as well. How does the dynamic change between maybe preparing something for the likes of a national retailer like a Kohl's versus working on a one-to-one level with some of those boutique retailers?
We do a couple things different there. We've got some merchandising units, display units, so freestanding displays that we offer those individual retailers who don't necessarily have the same amount of space that a large retailer would have. We also offer custom product. So exclusive products that are only available to those small mom and pop or individual retailers. So they don't feel like they're competing necessarily with the large retailers. There's a few things that we do differently. We're also very cognizant of pricing. We're not an off-brand at all. So we really try to encourage our retail partners, big and small, you know, to take advantage of the category. It's a very robust category from a margin perspective. It's the high turn category. And so they should take advantage of that, maintaining pricing. And that's one of the things that we found that retailers like about the category is that it's a great margin business for them. And so, yes, it can build traffic, but can also be just a great ROI on whatever real estate that they dedicate to the space.
Now, I want to take us back to March of this year. And as you mentioned, typically when you see recessionary pressure and that type of thing, candy sales go up in the retail universe. But while a few of your retailers that you work with, Winco and the Fresh Market and so forth, were able to stay open, there were a number of retailers that were either forced to close or chose to close for the first few months of the pandemic onset here in the U.S. But one of the things I found was interesting is it didn't affect your sales at all. In fact, your sales went up in Q2 and Q3 year over year. How did what happened in March through May kind of change your operational focus as a company?
It's a great question. For perspective, we'll be up this year 7x in revenue over 2019. So you can see the kinds of success that we're having from a revenue standpoint. What happened though with our brick and mortar business starting in March, we went from the run rate that we were on to zero for a 4-month period. We really didn't ship any retailers from end of February, any brick and mortar retailers outside the couple of grocery chains that you mentioned, really until the end of July. So that business went to zero, and yet we're still up 7x for the year. And what we did was we pivoted during that time towards online e-commerce retailers. So they found the same thing that the mass market knows, and also what we've been able to prove in the white space opportunity and specialty market, that you can really sell confectionery anywhere. Any retailer can sell it. It's a great add-on sale. It's a great, somebody may not make a purchase at a particular time for whatever the core merchandise is of that particular e-commerce store, but they may end up choosing candy on the way out, you know, as it's presented in the sales funnel. So the online e-commerce retailers that we found, some of them are pure plays, just happen to be online retailers selling fashion. They might be influencers. We've got a following of 10 to 50,000 influencers, and they're selling fashion goods. And we are partnering with about 7,000 of those from really zero once the pandemic hit. We really, you know, leaned in there. We have about 7,000 of those partners right now that are also selling the product, and they're having great success with it. We see a 90% quarter over quarter reorder rates in each one of them with accelerating reorders. So they're ordering more and they're ordering often because they're finding that they can sell confectionery products as well. Again, it's not mass market product. I think if we were selling Snicker bars or M&Ms, it wouldn't work, but unique product that you can't find in your mass merchant, that really are only available in specialty market stores. And we bring in about 60% of our product is sourced from Europe, well-packaged at higher price points. It's very giftable, is really our USP. And that's why it's working well really everywhere we go.
Now, you talk about that from zero to 7,000 of these, you know, influencers and social media stores. How were you able to scale that quickly? What had to be undertaken as a company for you to jump from zero to 7,000 just at the drop of a hat like that?
Great question. There were a few different touch points that we used. There's some online marketplaces that bring together B2B customers and B2B manufacturers, retailers and manufacturers. And so we list our products there for sale. So that was one way. We've got a sales force, a dedicated sales force of 6 full-time professionals. And so we had them start, you know, moving their focus from brick and mortar to online digital customers. And then we did some lead generation campaigns. You know, typically people do lead generation campaigns for consumer facing businesses. And that's how we built the subscription base for Candy Club. But we took the same principles of buying, you know, keywords and going out there and advertising in social media, driving traffic towards a lead generation page that we have built, and then being able to capture those leads and convert them into customers. So there were multiple ways. We just had to get creative, really, because we couldn't let the business go to zero when COVID hit.
Lots of interesting levers it seems like you pulled during that period of time. I want to take a hard right turn now and ask you, you mentioned a little while ago that really your proposition is a lot different than, you know, the Snickers and the M&Ms of the world. Obviously, you know, those brands are fairly well known. They've been around for a while. Of course, you sell a lot more unique products, some of which are maybe retro or a callback to childhood, certainly for some customers. I was wondering if you could give us a few specific examples of some of the unique products that you offer underneath the Candy Club brand.
Yeah, so we have Sour Belts are one of our very key categories, theme gummies. So we'll do some interesting, you know, cosmic themed, dinosaur themed. So there's a lot of retro in there. We have really a mandate that nothing that you would find in the mass market is anything that we'll put in our line. So it's just really differentiated through theme, through color, through taste palette. But what we do is we represent sort of a subset of the entire candy industry, so to speak. So there's subsegments, there's chocolates, there's sours, there's gummies, there's taffies and licorice. And so we try to cover the gamut there. But again, we do it with a unique twist on it. Instead of just a licorice, we'll have a dog-shaped licorice. Instead of just a regular sour we might have for Valentine's Day, we have sour smooch lips that are kissing-themed lips. So we try to put a twist on everything that we do.
Now, to that end, I was kind of curious if you're seeing from your position in the marketplace any type of momentum towards a particular type of candy within those silos you mentioned, silos like chocolate or licorice or sours. Are you seeing any particular momentum or maybe a switch in customer preference among those, or has it remained pretty steady over the past 5 years?
There's definitely been a couple of key trends. One of them is there's a flight to quality and artisanal in every category out there, and confectionery is no different. So premium chocolates, doing mashups between marshmallows and chocolates, you know, putting various categories together and really taking an artisanal approach, really higher price points to go along with that and better ingredients. I would say that's sort of all wrapped up into one. And then there's more themed, I'm not sure if themed is the right word, but people looking for very particular executions, whether they're gluten-free or sugar-free. Those are two, obviously, executions that are popular in other categories, and confectionery is no different. There's definitely been some trends there. The beauty about our model is we can very quickly adapt to go where consumer taste trends are applying.
So all that being said, that sets me up for the final question here. What's next for Candy Club? Where do you see the company headed over the next 1 to 2 years, other than obviously increasing sales, because it looks like forecast might be for even more retail doors by the end of Q4?
Yeah, so we're on a mission for world domination. We want to have our products everywhere that they can possibly be. And to get there, to that end, to answer your question, we've got some big product development initiatives right now to continue the flight to quality, more premium chocolates, more unique products that really you can't find anywhere else without getting into specific SKUs, new packaging executions. Right now, the packaging that we have for the products in department stores like Nordstrom Rack are the same as we're going into grocery store. So we've got an initiative to do some real differentiation, some higher price point executions for upstairs, maybe some more price sensitive for downstairs. So really making sure that we've got the right products faced off against the right distribution channels.
I know I said that was the last question, but I got to follow up on that there in terms of the packaging difference. What are some things that you've noticed in terms of maybe what consumers want or will go for across those different channels, whether it be in an upscale retailer, a department store, grocery store, that type of thing?
Without using an overused word, but it's got to be cute. People got to grab their attention. It's got to pop off the shelf. So it's got to be attention grabbing. Giftable really helps because this is a great stocking stuffer. It's a great add-on to a birthday. We sell themed gift sets that say thank you, or they come in 3-packs, or for birthday or particular theme. So really having these things, meet a particular need from a giftable standpoint is critical. And then the materials you use, the more tactile, and especially if they have a separate use, we find that people through our subscriptions, because we're shipping a lot of containers, they'll reuse them as pencil holders. They'll use them as arts and crafts projects. They'll use them as pottery to put plants in. So if there's a secondary use, that always comes in handy as well.
Phenomenal insight. We could talk all day about this, but I don't want to monopolize your time, Keith. I know you're a busy person, but thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. It's been fun.
Thank you very much for having me.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, once again, we thank Keith for joining us here on the show. It's always great when we can look at a subsegment of retail that's often overlooked. And Keith said it himself, candy retail doesn't get a lot of press. Every retailer cares a lot about it because it is such a high margin category, especially when you get outside of some of those front end staples like the Snickers and the M&Ms. When you get beyond that, candy can be a very high margin category for retailers, and it'll be important over the next few years for retailers to pay attention to that category, even if confectionery retail isn't something that they've done in the past. He mentioned that it's worked for them in just about every silo of retail that's out there. Well, we step into our looking ahead segment now, and we'll tell you about a story we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or perhaps year. And as we so often have during the course of the podcast, we begin with Leighton.
So my looking ahead story has to do with a pet retailer, not a brick and mortar one, but one we've talked about since their IPO back around mid-2019. Chewy has been chewing up, let's say, the market share for pet supplies and pet pharmacy goods over the internet. They're one of the leading e-commerce retailers in that particular category. If you look, Trent, they came out with third quarter earnings that beat pretty much every expectation out there from analysts. Now, I think it had to do with a number of factors. I will try to keep this brief, but I think this is really a good company to keep an eye on for the, I would say, immediate future, but even the long term, not necessarily from an investor perspective, but just really what they're doing in terms of e-commerce innovation and really enhancing the customer experience with what they sell. The online provider of pet food and products reported a net loss of 8 cents per share. So on the face of it, it looks bad, but actually that beat an expected net loss of around 14 cents per share. And to put that into an absolute amount of dollars, you're looking at a loss of around $32.8 million from a loss of around $79 million a year ago. You think, okay, the company's losing money, but it's actually not that much money because they brought in nearly $1.78 billion, a 45% year-over-year increase. And I think this has to do a lot with Black Friday and the Cyber Week. They said those net sales were up and making company's history in terms of sales records, but overall you're looking and you're seeing a customer base that is widened. There are a lot of new pet customers because pet adoptions are way up since the beginning of the pandemic. You're talking about thousands of new pet owners. And so with that, you're going to get what they call hard goods, not necessarily just those consumable items like food and other things. You're getting, let's say, cat towers for new cat owners like myself. And so those purchases typically carry higher margins. So it's going to help their bottom line as they begin to continue their growth pattern, their exponential growth right now in acquiring their customers. However, what I found interesting was that nearly $1.2 billion from the second quarter was actually brought in. So roughly two-thirds of the revenue was brought in by AutoShip. So if you're looking at their orders, you're seeing that people love their platform and they're continuing to buy on a monthly basis those routine goods. And I think that's really good because they have that stickiness that those leaders like to talk about. And so I think that's really good. And I think if you're looking at that nearly 70% net sales ratio, that $1.2 billion of the $1.8 billion on that AutoShip, you're also going to get a lot more revenue growth long-term as those new pet owners begin to get really immersed in their program. And lastly, Trent, I will say it is just fascinating. I mentioned briefly, but their pet pharmacy division has just exploded more than $500 million in gross revenue this year. And they believe that they take nearly 40% of the online market share within that particular segment by their own estimates. And I think that's really, really good because if they can have an all-encompassing platform where you have pretty much everything pet-related, they can really dominate the space. And I will say from personal experience, having used that platform, they have excellent pricing, excellent customer service. Their shipping is excellent. I ordered one thing for my new cat as part of our cat family here, but it came in one day. And so anytime you're talking about big e-commerce giants like Amazon that are able to provide that customer service in a way where you can expect 1 to 2 day free shipping, I think they've really nailed it. And I think Chewy's platform just does an excellent job of conveying that. And they also have really good sales and rebates also for those new pet customers out there.
My looking ahead story has to do with warehouse club retail as Costco released earnings. And I'm going to look back slightly at their earnings. I think the big headline for a lot of media outlets was the fact that online grocery grew 300% for Costco. But I'm going to be honest, like if you went to Costco's online platform a year ago and looked at their grocery offerings, it was really paltry. So it couldn't help but jump by that amount in this quarter. That's not what I'm looking ahead at. No, what I'm looking ahead at is sales from membership fees, which jumped 7.1% for Costco in this quarter, which is their fiscal Q1. The reason I'm looking ahead at this is because we always kind of keep track of membership fees as a way to gauge whether or not companies are gaining or losing market share, but also a way to gauge whether more people are going to warehouse clubs. And the hypothesis is this: since the pandemic started, people are making fewer trips. We know that. Might make sense for certain consumers who didn't have memberships for warehouse clubs at the beginning of the pandemic to eventually come around to that idea rather than going to the traditional grocer and stocking up. Maybe you're going to Costco or Sam's or BJ's and stocking up on bulk food purchases. So this is a pretty substantial number for Costco. And again, it's not all because of their hikes in membership fees. You're seeing a lot of organic new members as well at Costco. So I'm keeping an eye on the three main players in this space to see if this trend continues out of the pandemic, or if next June, let's say, people realize that, hey, maybe they don't need to stock up. Maybe there's a vaccine that's been given to most of the population. Maybe they don't need to buy 50-pound bags of rice at these stores. Maybe they let their memberships wane. So really what I'm looking ahead to is about a year from now, where are these membership fee sales going to be for Costco, Sam's, and BJ's? Will there be that much organic growth in new members next year? And I think that's going to be a key part to look at as we look at the warehouse club retail segment. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus podcast. A big thanks to Leighton, of course, for joining us on air this week. Also, a thanks to Keith Cohn of Candy Club for taking time out of his day to join us. Coming up on Wednesday's podcast, next Wednesday's podcast, we'll be joined by Melissa Wong. She is the CEO of Retail Zipline, who basically has built a communication platform to be used within retail companies. So we're going to talk about how communication within a retail location has changed, but also between leadership at a retailer and the individual stores. It's a fascinating conversation, one that takes on many facets, and I hope you'll join us for that coming up Wednesday. Until then, so long.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.